Morrison's workplace wrecking ball, the daggy dad with the deeply political agenda, and a whole bunch of good news. This is The Week on Wednesday. Hello and welcome to The Week on Wednesday. I'm your host, Ben Davison, and with me, as always, is the vibrant, the gregarious, I'm sure I said that wrong, Guardian columnist and theatre maker extraordinaire, and my lovely fiancée, Van Badham. How are you this morning, Van?
As you know, not real well, but I'm giving it a red hot go. How are you?
I'm okay, thank you very much. I'm really looking forward to the end of the year. Hasn't 2020 been the year where we reassessed how terrible 2019 was?
Yes, here were we thinking that 2019 was an absolute basket fire of just terrible disasters, and yet 2020 surpassed all expectations. I do recommend everybody read my piece that was released in The Guardian this week, where I go through things like reported UFO sightings, murder hornets, an epidemic of snakes across America, the zombie mink of Denmark, and all the other kinds of events that in any other year would have been considered so absolutely terrifying that they would have been front page news for months. They just got lost, actually, amongst all the other stuff that was going on. So well done, 2020, surpassing everybody's expectations of how absolutely terrible a year can be.
And we will do an interview show later in December. We will do some more shows.
We're going to have a couple of weeks off over Christmas, as Ben and I have a lot of books we need to read.
But we will do a wrap-up episode of 2020 so you can hear more about the zombie mink of Denmark. What a line that is. The zombie mink of Denmark.
If it's not a novel in the next 12 months, I just don't even know the publishing community anymore.
But what we need to talk about today is something that is going to impact every single Australian who has a job or wants a job or is an employer of people, particularly small business people, and of course is handing a big free kick to large, already profitable, already doing very well, thank you very much, corporations in this country.
We are, of course, talking about the Liberal Party's IR omnibus bill, which Sally McManus from the ACTU has referred to as the ominous bill. Why is it ominous, Ben? Could it be because it's taking a wrecking ball to working people in this country?
Oh, absolutely taking a wrecking ball to the rights of working people, to the wages of working people, and really to the jobs of working people. So we've already been talking about industrial relations and workplace reform changes over the last few months, particularly as COVID came in and there was a need to really shore up people's jobs and shore up particularly small business.
And there was a lot of discussion about the need for security. And of course,
absolutely,
there was a massive outcry. I wrote about it in The Guardian about the fact that the casualisation of the workplace in Australia, remembering, of course, 40% of Australians now work in casual work. It's one of the highest rates in the OECD.
Yeah.
It means that one of the reasons why coronavirus and places where coronavirus has spread is where people don't have leave entitlements and where people don't have secure work, where people ignore the cough or the sore throat and go to work because if they don't go to work, they don't get paid. If they call in sick, they can lose their job. So there's been a national scandal about casualisation that people have been banging the drum about for years. And finally, with coronavirus, we came to understand, not just in Australia, but across the world, that casualised labour was a social evil that made us all unsafe. And what's happening with casualised labour, Ben? Go on, tell us what's in the IR bill.
Well, really, there's a bit of lip service here. So we saw the states during the COVID crisis take some real leadership. Victoria did that. They brought in essentially some paid time off for people who were sick. They're trialling additional leave now for people who are in casual positions that are at the front line of things like pandemics. But what's in the Morrison bill is essentially more smoke and mirrors. So at the moment, if you're a casual and you, in most industries, you work for 12 months in the same role, you can ask to be converted to a permanent ongoing role. That's in most of the awards.
You can ask.
That's in most of the awards, right? In some agreements, they have it that you can ask. In some agreements, they have it that you're automatically converted. Now, that's where you've got a good, strong union agreement. What the IR bill, the omnibus bill, is proposing to do is to say that all casuals can ask to be made ongoing and permanent. Now, there's no recourse here for any kind of appeal. So if your employer says, no, we can't do it, then that's it. That's the end of the story. Now, Morrison's ministers are out there saying, oh, well, you can go to conciliation if the boss agrees. if the corporation agrees to go to conciliation, they still don't have to agree to what the conciliator says. They conciliator can say, look, this is an ongoing role. There's no question. This person's been doing this for 12 months. They've had the same roster for 12 months. This is work that's ongoing. It's a core part of your business. You should make them
it's
ongoing.
It's not seasonal.
It's not seasonal in any way. If the employer doesn't agree, the employer doesn't have to do it. Now, oh, but don't, it's got to be reasonable. It's got to be reasonable, says Morrister's ministers. Well, I can tell you that I got an email today from a newsletter that goes out to HR directors. In my former capacity as a chief of staff, I signed up to some of these things just to have a look to see.
Just to keep your eye on
just
them.
Just to keep an eye on them.
You can see why I love this man, right? Listeners.
There is an article entitled Why Morrison's IR Changes Are a Golden Ticket for Employers. And the article goes on to outline how all of these so-called safeguards and conversions and opportunities for casuals are a nonsense. It literally says things like the definition of reasonable business need is so wide that there's no potential for it to impact the decision that the boss makes, i.e. if you decide the casual is not being made permanent, the casual is not being made permanent. It's as simple as that. Of course, there's a more sinister side here too. Now, I don't want to suggest for a moment that everybody who employs somebody is a bad person. That's clearly not the case. But we do know that when there is a race to the bottom on wages in any industry, then people get sucked down into the vortex of doing the wrong thing. And if casuals are coming and asking to be made permanent and ongoing, there will be some employers who go, I don't want you here anymore. You're a troublemaker.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, we've seen this with wage theft and the whole issue around underpayment of workers. There was another scandal this week about wage theft where one of the many privatised childcare providers one of the privatised childcare providers was found to have stiffed its employees for $60 million of unpaid wages. And that's G8 Education. And this affected, they think, as many as 27,000 staff.
Yeah.
And
this is a huge company. This is a publicly listed company.
Yeah, this is a massive, massive company. 27,000 people underpaid. Now, isn't it funny, Ben, when corporations and employers make the argument about wage theft that it was just a mistake and, oh, the awards are so complicated, that nobody ever actually overpays their workers?
Yeah, well, that's right.
It is just an extraordinary coincidence that we never have a worker overpayment scandal in this country, despite the fact that so many profitable, massive corporations that employ literal armies of accountants and auditors and everything else and get the best financial and legal advice they can afford, because you can bet that they do. Isn't it funny that they consistently underpay? And this is, of course, the framework with casualisation. When you put more and more power into what the employer can decide about your workplace, you do actually facilitate a culture of exploitation and greed.
Of course. And this is another part of the omnibus bill, is the provisions around wage theft. So, of course, lots of people, the union movement, lots of people outside the union movement as well, have been calling for criminalisation of wage theft. And we've seen that now in Victoria, in Queensland and the ACT, that there's quite a decent bar which has to be cleared for somebody to be called a wage theft criminal, but it's there. And if you are systemically ripping people off, you can go to jail.
Yay! Right?
Proper wage theft laws. Of course, what Morrison's minister's omnibus bill does is make that bar so high that no one's ever likely to be prosecuted. And yes, they're bringing in some additional penalties at a civil level. So you might be fined three times what your economic benefit of these of your wage theft might be. Interesting that there's been a massive wage theft scandal come out and somebody coughing up to it before this goes through, by
the way. Yes, isn't that interesting? A couple of companies have done that.
But what people are saying, and I think they're absolutely right, is that it's all well and good to have higher penalties, but if you don't have the mechanisms to enforce it, i.e. unions still can't get on site easily, workers are still casualised and don't have the job security to raise issues, you don't have a tribunal that can quickly hear these cases and deal with the issue in a way that encourages people to bring them forward before they get to this massive 27,000 individuals being affected kind of level.
To the tune of $60 million.
Then actually none of these provisions will be enacted. And that's what we're seeing in this omnibus bill, right? All of the things that would be useful or potentially helpful for working people, you know, proper casual conversion, proper definition of casual, access to remediation for when your wages are stolen, access to justice. Mm. These things are not being put in place properly. At the same time, on the flip side, the things that employers really want...
They're getting a golden ticket, Ben.
They're getting a golden ticket.
Golden ticket and a magic bus.
Well, they're watering down.
Oh, I just realised they put a pun in that email. I only just got it. Golden ticket for the omnibus bill.
No.
Oh my God.
That's
oh
terrible, isn't it?
Oh my God.
I'm sure there are some nice HR professionals out there.
And when we meet one, we'll let you know.
But the side of this debate that is getting everything it wants is the big business side, right? So one of the things big business has wanted for a long time was to get rid of the better off overall test, which is part of how agreements are negotiated. Now, Morrison's ministers have been saying that we need more enterprise bargaining. We need more bargaining happening in the system. That's how we'll get wages going. And it's all declining because it's all too difficult and it's all red tape. And so what is their suggestion? Their suggestion is, well, the Commission will have to approve agreements within 21 days, and they don't have to worry about the better off overall test anymore. If the agreement makes people worse off, that's okay. This is not how you get bargaining going. This is how you undermine the bargaining power of working people. Actually.
And it also means that you get generations of people who are employed on worse conditions and worse pay than the previous generation of workers. You actually create incentives within the system to lay people off so you can rehire people on worse wages and conditions.
And we've seen that. We saw that with work choices, where work choices agreements were in place for years, for decades after Work Choices was officially dead, buried and cremated. Well, I don't think it is dead, buried and cremated because there's a little bit of zombie.
It's a zombie mink. It's a Danish zombie mink. Oh,
it's a Morrison zombie mink.
All the threads of 2020 come together.
And that's what we're seeing, right? So we've saw how labour hire was abused, particularly in places like mining, where you would hire people on casual, so-called casual labour hire contracts to undermine your existing EBA so you could pay them less. Even with the so-called loading, you had people getting paid less than ongoing staff. What this does is this gets rid of the kind of sleight of hand. You don't even need the sleight of hand anymore. You can just leave, cut people's pay.
You can just leave people worse off.
You can just leave people worse off.
People don't need to be better off overall. They can just be worse off.
They can just be
Thank
worse
you,
off.
Scott Morrison. Thank you, Christian Porter. Thank you, Alan Tudge. Let's throw them all in. Because what we know is the Liberal Party always does this. This is what they fundamentally believe. And it absolutely does my head in when people seem to think that the Liberals just do working class drag. You know, they put on their shiny high vis and point at things on construction sites and, you know, go to a few barbecues and affect bad working class accents. And we know that what they, you know, I always have this vision of the Liberal Party in their, you know, high vis outfits. And then they go off to clubs like the Athenaeum Club, which Malcolm Turnbull was very famously a member of. And then they have a change room and they put on their top hats and their monocles and their tuxedos and they go into the smoking room and they talk about how jolly good it is to just kick those peasants a bit more. Kick, 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 kick.
There was a little bit of news that people might have missed today, yesterday.
About Matt Canavan.
So Matt Canavan, of course, famously said that he was very proud to have represented the mining industry.
And hasn't he got the high-vis vest to prove it, Ben?
He sure does. But you know how he gets the high-vis vest? Is that his brother owned a coal mine.
No.
His brother owned a coal mine.
What a surprise. And his brother also went broke owning a coal mine.
Indeed.
Wow, it's almost like the global market around fossil fuels is shifting, Ben. Isn't that crazy?
And that maybe Liberals aren't that good at business. But there's more in the omnibus bill. This is the thing. These bills, right, this is the last parliamentary sitting week. It's December. Everyone's winding down. It's been a hell of a year. And this omnibus bill, this ominous bill, has been introduced into the parliament today, right? Today. There's one sitting day left of the year. This will go on into 2021 now, right? But of course, it'll be 6 weeks before people really look at the detail again. And here's some more detail. So there was a court case called Rosado versus WorkPac, which goes to the heart of using labour hire, falsely calling people casuals and paying people less than your ongoing employees, right? This happens in mining quite a bit. It happens in other places too, but it's predominantly an issue in mining and some manufacturing. What the court found was that you can't just call someone a casual, tell them they're working the hours, the days, the shifts they're working for 2 years in advance, give them no capacity to say no, right? And essentially pay them less than you would be paying your ongoing staff and get away with it. So this court case has said, actually, you owe this person money. You owe this worker money. You owe any worker in this situation money. Now, of course, Morrison's ministers and his big business lobby mates have gone bananas about this for months.
How dare you pay people what they're owed?
The Morrison government has said that they'll back a high court challenge. They've put provisions in this omnibus bill.
Funded by taxpayers.
Of course, funded by
the
taxpayers.
The taxpayers will fund a case that will leave ordinary working people worse off.
Yeah, that's
great.
Right.
Great, awesome.
Your
awesome.
Tax Fantastic. Dollars at work taking
Vote
money
liberal,
out of your
everybody.
Pocket.
Vote Liberal.
But
yep.
What the omnibus bill seeks to do is to remove all of that obligation retrospectively. So the Morrison ministers, oh, it's $29 billion or $39 billion. Well, it's not that much. Let's be perfectly clear. It's not going to be that much. It would never be that much. But this is the hyperbole, right? It'll send the economy broke. Of course it won't send the economy broke. And what's more, the only people who are punished by this ruling are those dodgy employers who have broken the law. So they're retrospectively making it legal to have ripped off all of these workers.
Now, retrospectively.
So they go. The omnibus bill says, if you did that in the past, that's okay. Don't worry about total amnesty
for the real victims here, who are the multinational corporations who are exploiting Australian working people.
It's an outrageous thing to even try to justify. If you have taken the rights and the money of working people, you should have to pay that back. And however you want to try and justify it. And we've seen the business lobbyists come out and go, oh, well, they were called casuals and they got a loading and it's double dipping. It's not double dipping. These people were paid less than people they worked alongside. And that's one of the things that has come out this week as well, is that research by David Peets, the renowned academic from Griffith University, has found that up to 50% of casuals are not getting the 25% loading that Morrison's ministers claim is all the compensation that people are getting for being casual. They're actually not getting it. Half of casuals are not getting it at all. We see in industry after industry after industry, reports come out suggesting that people move their staff to casual models because they can save money. Now, if you can save money, cash money, on moving people to casual, that says there's no loading. That says there's no compensation. It's not that, oh, you'll break even, right? Theoretically, you should be breaking even, right? If the loading compensates people for what they would lose, it should be a one-to-one, but it's not. It's not. And that's what this court has found. This court has found, the federal court has found, that workers were being ripped off. Labour hire companies, multinational corporations were benefiting from this, and that people working alongside somebody else doing exactly the same job in exactly the same circumstances were getting paid less than their workmate.
I think we need to drill down into why this happens, like, ideologically, and it comes from a real sense of conviction on the neoconservative side of politics that Scott Morrison and Christian Porter represent so perfectly. And it's this fundamentally held belief that if you are an employee rather than an employer, well, you're some kind of suckling or dependent, that you should be grateful just to have a job, that you are a lesser person because you don't own the means of production, you are subject to the means of production. And they really believe this. Like, there is no commitment to egalitarianism in any of this policy. There's no fundamental respect or acknowledgement of dignity or the fundamental equality of all people when you create a system that says, if you work for me, I will have all the advantage. You will have a supplicant. You can ask for things, but you have no entitlement to get them. And I can leave you worse off. I can create an agreement that leaves you worse off. Like, that's genuinely frightening.
And I think that if we go back to first principles, the point of having industrial relations laws is to equalise the power between employers and employees. And as you say, the Morrison government does not believe that that should be an equal relationship.
No, they don't.
It just doesn't believe it. You know, in every aspect of the omnibus bill, every aspect of it seeks to move even more power to the employer column. And that's what it does. It moves the power to the employer column.
When we know that employers in this country have been, like JAD Education, greedy, exploitative, lazy. I mean, a lot of
and profitable.
But a lot of the rhetoric is always, oh, we've just got to loosen the shackles of business so they can go out there and innovate. That's the last thing they do. Like, the easier you make things for employees in terms of their employer-employee relations, the more liberties they take. I mean, it is ridiculous that you have the business lobby jumping up and down about that WorkPack decision when they should never, ever have had the capacity to employ people as casuals in what were effectively permanent positions anyway.
Absolutely.
The fact that legislation, thanks to the Liberal Party, has gotten so loose in this country that that was able to happen in the first place, and yet that advantage just gets pressed further and further and further. Essentially, what we're making out of the owners of particularly multinational corporations is a new aristocracy.
And it happens because there's no lobby group on the business side that actually wants a living level playing field.
Of course they don't.
They're so obsessed with the market ideology. And of course, in market ideology, the end point of every market is that price equals cost and cost equals price because it's perfect competition. The problem in the labour market is that we're not talking about lumps of coal or bushels of wheat or even manufactured radios. We're talking about people's lives. So if you reduce wages to the point of perfect competition in their perfect ideology, you almost end up basically at slavery.
Well, this is always the argument, you know. I think it's an American who had the quote, I can't remember who it is, about minimum wage.
Mm.
The thing you have to remember about people who argue against minimum wage is that these are people who would pay you nothing if they could get away with it.
Absolutely.
And that's where we are, you know.
That's
and
exactly
it's a fundamental belief that working people are lesser and undeserving. And I think we need to talk about the impact on households that all of these changes are having, because we know that we have record low wage growth. But you threw a bunch of figures at me yesterday because we have this very, you know, romantic, intense relationship of macroeconomic discourse in our house about how much the amount of money that Australian households are spending on things like groceries is in decline.
That's right.
And not because prices are going down.
No,
they
that's
aren't.
Right. It's because GDP per capita has gone down $850.
Gross domestic product.
Yes, $850 in the last quarter, right, per person. That means we're all nearly $1,000 worse off
than we were when?
3 months ago.
3 months ago.
Yep.
From 3 months ago, we're $1,000 worse off.
That's what that means.
Oh,
if it's gone down
great.
By that in a quarter, that's what one of the reports is. We've seen spending on groceries go down per week. Gone down $7, so from $137 to $130.
So let's just...
For a whole household.
This is the median or the average?
This is the average.
The average. So the average for a household, and we know if it's the average, that means there are households that spend heaps and heaps and heaps of money, which sort of blow out what we would expect to be the most
common. And households, of course, that don't have any money to spend at the other end.
$130 a week
for
a household, which in Australia, a standard household is what? 2.7
I think it's about
seven people.
No, I think it's 2.2, something like that. But even so, you're talking about trying to feed multiple people on $130 a week and fund the grocery bill. Now, when you undermine wages, when you undermine job security, which also undermines wages, by the way.
I love the industrial sounds in the background at our house, by the way.
So we've got this situation where not only will pay cuts be baked into this new, more flexible agreement system, but you'll also bake in the fundamental insecurity which will drag wages down over the medium term as well. We've seen that. The more jobs become insecure, the harder it is to bargain, the harder it is to get a pay rise, and the less wages go up. There's no There's no secret to it. It's not magic. You can see it every time. Highly unionised, secure workers get better pay rises than de-unionised, casual workers who get no pay rises, right? So you've got baked-in pay cuts. You've got the dragging down of wages. Of course this impacts people's spending. Of course this impacts people's...
Which has a massive impact on small business.
Of course.
Because small business, like, you know, our local retail, our local hospitality, you know, our local services, you don't go to them if you don't have the money to go to them.
And we're seeing cuts in all of those areas. Now, of course, COVID plays a role in that as well. But the main thing that drives people's spending habits is their sense of security. That's why you see on the news so often, you know, consumer confidence is such a big deal for business and how business plans. Because if consumers aren't confident, and yes, consumer confidence has gone up, of course, because COVID's come down. But I can guarantee you that if you don't feel secure in your employment, if you can't see a horizon with wage increases, then you don't spend money. And we've seen that again and again and again and again. And that's one of the things that is so disappointing about this IR omnibus bill, right? Is that it ignores history. It ignores fact. It ignores the observable.
It ignores data. It ignores patterns. It ignores international benchmarking. You know,
everything that
people
we know.
Go through. And but it's what I say every week. You know, people think the Liberals will somehow be persuaded by morality, or the Liberals will be persuaded by the facts. They're not. They're committed to an ideological end game, which is about privileging a small group of rich people with more advantage and to hell with everyone else. And that's it. Like, they fundamentally believe that. That's a principle that they literally go into Parliament to defend and to engineer systems to support. And the idea that anybody would think it was different is... just defies history.
And this comes to a point that you've raised before too, is that they're prepared to say whatever it takes...
to get elected.
To get elected, and they're prepared to make whatever argument they believe is required to implement these sorts of policies. I mean, they have been up telling lies about this bill since before it was even introduced.
Oh, well, we've had for the past couple of weeks, oh, if you're a casual, you know, you're going to be able to ask your employer to make you permanent. And all of this spin around how this is actually a great opportunity. Oh, yeah, that'd be cool. I love permanent conditions kind of thing. That's not what the bill is about.
No.
Like, and the bill is actually eroding that capacity within the system as it stands and leaving people with fewer rights. But they are willing to spin it and spin it and spin it and, of course, put on their outfits and, oh, there's Scott Morrison. I know how you love talking about this. In his shorts and his suit jacket, because he's just like us, getting his photo taken with a professional photographer that accompanies him everywhere, just like you and me.
I mean, you and I perpetually
have a professional photographer, as you can tell from, you know, my Instagram. I'm always so beautifully styled. And this whole thing about Morrison is just like, oh, he's building a chicken coop. He's put up Christmas lights. Oh, so relatable. So relatable. Well, in his harbourside mansion paid for by the taxpayer.
Well, that brings us, I think, to the next topic we need to talk about, and that is...
how the next Labor government should sell Kirribilli House so Liberals can't live there anymore, because I think that's a great idea.
No, I was going to say the daggy dad with the deeply political agenda, right? And we saw it this week. It really disgusted me earlier in the week when I saw the headlines.
Listeners,
that said,
that's an understatement.
The headlines that said things like big win for casuals, because it came straight out of the Morrison ministers and the Morrison government.
Oh, some newspapers are just replicating the press releases.
And we see them publishing the photos of Morrison, from, you know, in his shorts and building a chicken coop. A million Australians were unemployed. A million Australians were unemployed. Household incomes were being smashed. People were getting sick. Tens of thousands of Australians were being tested every single day for a virulent disease that had swept the world. Our entire airline industry has been gutted. Jobs have been outsourced. And what does Scott Morrison do? He builds a bloody chicken coop. And what does the media do? It covers him building a bloody chicken coop.
That's a very
He should have been
story.
Condemned. What we've seen is time and time and time again, people running this daggy dad narrative. He can make a curry. I don't care. He can make a curry.
But Ben, it's rhetorically really effective. I mean, we were having this discussion the other day. We were hanging out with our friends who, you know, interesting representative sample of Australians.
Sorry, I lost my cool there a little
bit.
I
just you did. Went you did, off darling.
Tap.
You did. And we, you know, we have a friend in particular who's like, I just don't want to talk about politics. Like, she's just one of those people.
Yeah.
And a lot of Australians are like that. But you made the point that, you know, we all sat down and we had a curry for lunch with our friends. And you were like, she's the kind of person who, if we weren't there, probably would have gone, oh, just like the Prime Minister, you know, he likes a curry. And that's what it is. It's this brilliant marketing gambit.
It is.
You know, and again and again, and I said this, I wrote about this for The Guardian when I was like, the thing is, most people I don't think buy it, but it looks like he's trying to be like us. He's aping the way that we live our lives, and that's a sort of communication in itself. I don't think anybody is under the impression that Scott Morrison is just like you and me. He's from a wealthy eastern suburbs family.
Yeah.
He went to a very exclusive selective school in Sydney. He was a rugby player before his conversion, of course, to rugby league, because it's so much more common. You know, he spends Kirribilli House is his preferred residence, you know, on the harbour. He spent $5,000 of taxpayers' money, this came out recently, for him and Joshie Frydenberg to go to Lachlan Murdoch's Christmas party while Australia was on fire. Literally when Scott Morrison was saying, I don't hold the hose, mate, and ordinary Australians were defending their communities with the hoses.
Yeah.
You know, trying to keep their houses standing. Scott Morrison was spending taxpayer money going to a party at a media billionaire's house. Like, that's who he really is. But I think for a lot of Australians who find politics confusing, depressing, chaotic and all those things, I mean, you and I live for this stuff and look how angry we get. I mean, we get so emotionally invested in this stuff that I think a lot of people, you know, people with kids, people with mortgages, people with jobs, want to get on with their lives. And Scott Morrison presents this really simple image where it looks like he's trying. It looks like he's a trier. And at the same time, we get these Trojan horse bills that absolutely shred everything that is valuable about Australian life, like egalitarianism, like you should be able to hold down a full-time job with permanent conditions and have time to spend with your family and not have your life dominated by your job. That's supposed to be the fundamental Australian promise. 8 hours rest, 8 hours work, 8 hours play. Like, that's the fundamental labour contract that this country fought for and determined as an international standard about how a society should be run.
And it's the fact that...
God, we're really angry.
Oh, well, it's because we've got a Prime Minister who is, as you say, aping ordinary people's lives, because most people don't want to think about politics. They don't. And it's fair enough too. We've got enough to worry about. When you've got insecure work, you've got high mortgage payments, you know.
God help you if you've got kids with problems
as well.
You've got
kids. Like,
you know,
just,
or if you need childcare or you've got dependent parents and you need aged care.
It's so difficult as it is, right? You've just got to kind of get through each day. And you know, more and more I sort of get that. But at the same time, you need political leaders to lead. And let's be really clear about this. As I like to say, let's be really clear about this.
You
it's
do
not,
say that a lot.
It's
Ben
not,
loves to be clear.
It's
loves
not
to be
that
clear.
Morrison isn't doing...
Don't be unclear near Ben.
It's not that Morrison isn't doing political things. He's just not fronting them, right? You've got a cavalcade of Morrison government ministers doing deeply political, deeply ideological things, whether it's Christian Porter and his omnibus bill, whether it's Paul Fletcher basically threatening to sack the ABC board for reporting on the behaviour of Morrison ministers. You've got Jane Hume out there pushing...
My friend Jane Hume.
Pushing for things that will leave every Australian worker worse off in retirement, right, by undermining the industry super sector, right, and propping up the retail industry sector, the retail super sector. You've got Morrison government ministers defending robo debt even after having to settle. You've got Morrison ministers putting forward the cashless welfare card, right? You've got Morrison ministers getting rid of free childcare and refusing to improve the childcare system.
Oh, and not funding universities.
Not funding universities.
Not creating educational opportunities, not directly investing in jobs.
Like, signing trade deals that are meaningless.
Completely meaningless. Oh, and hasn't it been funny for you and I? So, listeners, Ben and I campaigned very hard against the Chinese-Australian Free Trade Agreement. You know, obviously, I wrote about it for The Guardian. There were provisions in that agreement that were absolutely appalling. There's a direct capacity in the Chinese-Australian Free Trade Agreement to sell out Australian jobs.
Yeah.
That if you have 15%, all you need is 15% of Chinese investment in a project that's worth more than $150 million and workers can be shipped in from China. All of these things. And the trade union movement got up and said, this is outrageous. This is an appalling trade deal. There has been no transparency around this. And what did that trade deal get us exactly, Ben? The great trade deal that Scott Morrison is defending.
Well, it's seen Australian barley rotting on the docks. It's seen Australian wine sitting in the vats. It's seen Australian beef turned away from Chinese markets. It's now seeing Australian lamb and mutton turned away from Chinese markets. And even after all of that, the Morrison government ministers still went and signed RCEP. And it's just, it's a cavalcade of these things, right? We saw the
Wait a second, there's an agreement called RCEP?
Yeah, RCE, Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership Plan.
RCEP.
RCEP. I know.
Yeah, thanks everyone.
And frankly,
golden ticket on an omnibus. Yay, yeah. Bring in the marketing department.
I mean, it's just the cavalcade, right? You saw the Brereton report come out. This is a horrendous thing. You know, Morrison didn't front it. He rolled out the head of the Defence Force to front it. This is a man who is incapable of actually leading. Behind the scenes, his ideology is contaminating every aspect of Australian life, whether it's trade, childcare, aged care, right?
Veterans Affairs.
What does he do, right? He pulls all the strings. He makes all of his ministers front all of these things. He comes out
and puts up some Christmas lights. Just like you and me.
It's a disgrace. It really is a disgrace. And frankly, I think, as you say, people are kind of wise to it a little bit. But we need the media. We need the opposition, whether you're the Labor Party, the Greens, One Nation, Centre Alliance, whatever they're called now. If you're not in government and you believe that government should lead, you've got to stand up to this. Because these things get done under the radar.
You made a really good point the other day when you talked about how all of the gimmicks that go with Morrison, you can't do from opposition.
That's right.
So you can't dress up in your daggy dad outfit or put your high vis on and prance about making, you know, curries at a, like, whatever he does. Yeah. I can't bear it. In opposition, you've just got to attack. And I think it's quite fair to say, and I've said this publicly, that Tony Abbott really set a standard for opposition leader. Like, Tony Abbott couldn't govern, couldn't lead, couldn't rule, you know, like couldn't walk in a straight line. But he was certainly couldn't negotiate a trade deal, as Britain, I think, is finding out to their peril. But what Tony Abbott could definitely do was be an opposition leader, because the attacks on the Gillard government were relentless, you know, and poked holes in everything, constantly had the government scrutinised and made so much noise that he couldn't be ignored, to the point where a majority of Australians were convinced that that Labor government was a schmozzle and that there was no plan and that everything was a disaster, when at the time Gillard passed more legislation than with a minority government than any Prime Minister had since John Curtin. But the image of chaos and dysfunction that was created by Abbott was, as a political achievement, was extraordinary.
And it's thematic, right? It's about chaos and dysfunction. It's about cost to you. It's about how you're disadvantaged as a householder, and it's not letting these things go, right? And I know that there are lots of really important issues, that people on the left of politics, myself included, care about, and we want to talk about, and we want to make sure that everybody understands and everybody gets behind. But the reality is, most people don't care about politics. If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably in the minority of Australians who care about politics. And I just urge you, to make the focus of your energies to hold the government to account, not for the things that matter to you, but the things that matter to everybody. And that's things like workplace conditions, wages, job security. That's things like we can't sell our stuff and therefore we can't have a prosperous life.
We have no customers, so we can't run our shop.
The inequality in our tax system. That's another thing Morrison has done. You know, Morrison has made our tax system less equal and less fair, and he's pushed Josh Frydenberg out to do it. He's handed over billions of dollars to corporations and billions of dollars to high-income households. But it just sails through. So we have to bring the focus on Scott Morrison as Prime Minister signing off on all of these policies. This is his ideology. He is the daggy dad with a political agenda that if he turned up at Christmas and spouted these things off after a few drinks and he was your uncle, you'd throw him out of your house. You wouldn't have him there. But he runs the country. So I know that's a fairly sad, kind of almost depressing thing to say, but the good news is, on that front, that it's all there. We just have to pin it on him. He's doing it. It's there. You know, stop talking about Christian Porter. Stop talking about, you know, Paul Fletcher. Nobody knows who these people are.
Nobody knows who Paul Fletcher is.
Nobody cares.
Nobody in the arts knows who
Morrison's ministers.
He's minister
doing
for
this.
The arts.
Scott Morrison is in charge. Scott Morrison is responsible for 1 million Australians being unemployed. Scott Morrison is responsible for household incomes going backwards by nearly $1,000 per person. He is responsible for undermining your job security. He is responsible for dragging down your wages, and he is responsible for undermining your retirement. Scott Morrison is the Prime Minister, and Scott Morrison is responsible. Now, Van, I've waved my finger enough. Let's have some good news, shall we?
So they're rolling out the coronavirus vaccine in the UK, and the first recipient was a 91-year-old woman called Maggie Keenan, who was a former jewellery shop assistant and who has 4 grandchildren, and she's so proud to be part of history. So it is really exciting that there is a vaccine. Goes to show that investing in scientific research might be, oh, I don't know,
a good thing.
On that front as well, there's some good news in China, that China is massively stepping up industrial production of biodegradable plastics because China has a plastic problem, and the might of that kind of investment is overpowering, and hopefully will alter the dynamic of poor plastic use and consumption. I do have this plastic obsession, as has been mentioned in other programs, and Ben will knows. And the other thing is that the cast of Lord of the Rings, including Ian McKellen and Martin Freeman, are getting together to fundraise to buy J.R.R. Tolkien's old home, which he lived in I think he was there when he wrote The Hobbit and when he wrote The Lord of the Rings. And they're leading a fundraising effort. They want to buy it and turn it into a resource for Tolkien fans and aspiring writers.
Isn't that amazing?
Love the fact that those books and the experience of those movies had such an effect on those actors that they're like, this is important. This is historically important. Let's buy the house. That makes me very happy. So a good health story, a good environment story, and a good art and culture story. I needed 3 because Ben was just so upset. And being in our garage with Ben losing his mind, it sometimes can be a somewhat unsettling experience.
Well, thank you, Van, because I think those are all excellent news stories, and it shows that there is hope in the world.
Despite the Danish zombie mink.
There is a positive future for all of us.
Danish zombie mink.
And we can make positive changes for everyone.
We really, really can. So thank you for joining us. We will be back next week, and we will have a couple of weeks break after that, as I'm sure you understand. But because my mother is here,
hi, Mum.
Our house for the next 3 weeks. And, you know, we've got a lot on. So we hope you're all well and that you're gearing up for a lovely Christmas season. As always, get in touch. Let us know what you'd like us to talk about. Thank you for being loyal subscribers of the program, so many of you.
Don't forget to share the links. We are, of course, on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts,
Spotify.
Podbean is where the show is hosted. Feel free to subscribe on any of those channels. Leave us comments, engage, share it with your friends, talk to your friends, and we appreciate everything you do in your workplaces, in your homes, to get the message out and online. So that's the week on Wednesday. Love you, Benny.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Benny. I love you too.
Bye.
Bye.